Welcome to today's NPM podcast. Joining me today is Mike Reynolds, Managing Director of Ultra Capital, a private equity firm that invests in sustainable infrastructure, energy transition, and industrial decarbonization. It recently invested in front-of-the-meter storage developer On.Energy, and in the past has invested in community-oriented renewable developer and owner Aspen Power Partners. Mike, welcome to the program today.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Great. So just to kick us off, if you could just walk us through Ultra's business model as infrastructure growth equity.
Yeah, sure. So we think of ourselves as filling a gap in the funding marketplace that is growing and getting much deeper, particularly with the tailwinds in the industry. And so we sit between the venture capital world, which likes software and widgets and technology risk that isn't well suited for asset deployment, asset development. And sort of on the other end of that spectrum, we see private equity and traditional infrastructure, real asset capital that particularly likes scale. And so we see a growing number of companies sort of in this gap where they're deploying assets, they're in a development business or providing services sort of in this part of the market, but have huge opportunity to grow and scale. The challenge is they haven't yet attracted the size, or they don't want to have a controlled buyout acquisition of their company, and they haven't reached a size that attracts the interest of that next sort of larger wave of private equity that you see on Park Avenue, basically. So that's where Ultra Capital plays. We think of ourselves as in the $5 to $30 million check size range, and that can stem a few different uses for growth of these platforms, deploying in initial assets, development capital, scaling up teams. We have an investment team that comes from the infrastructure world as former developers, operators, bankers, financiers. So we really understand sort of where the end goal is for these businesses, whether they become IPPs or larger parts of a strategic portfolio, but really helping them scale and grow into that next wave of the life cycle. And like I said, we see this as a really exciting time and space that we see getting deeper with number of companies and opportunities, particularly as there's more sort of ESG infrastructure asset capital that requires a much larger check size. We're helping folks get up to that next tier of capital.
So what kind of returns, from a ballpark level are you guys typically looking at, and how does that comp against some of your peers?
Yeah, we're a private equity firm. So I'd say sort of generically private equity like returns. But what that also entails is us looking at companies that have a defensible downside position. And so we like to triangulate to a place where we feel we have a solid downside underwriting case that if things go slower or not according to plan, there's some defensible either asset base or sort of existing business that, has an underpinning to our investment, and then provides upside optionality from there. We see a lot of opportunity to scale and do multiple rounds with these companies. And I think we can also, having our capital be at the asset level or the company level, looks at different, return thresholds. But I would say on the whole, we, as labeled, we're a private equity investor looking for private equity like returns. And I don't think that's too different from some of our contemporaries that are in and around this in this part of the market.
So when we talk about clean energy, the amount of verticals which has seen investment has climbed quite a bit this year as we started to see some of the positive momentum from the Inflation Reduction Act spread not only to renewed runway for solar or wind, but also to standalone storage for the first time. And then some amended and increased enhancers for some other verticals that had been there before, like carbon capture, for instance. So from your perspective, what verticals have become interesting as of late to you from an investing perspective, and why?
Yeah, the first observation is that the number of verticals and their depth are just continuing to grow, and you're seeing whole new markets sort of create themselves out of infancy. I mean, it's pretty interesting just from an academic standpoint between, you know, solar, wind, and storage, and sort of the power generation mix. Green hydrogen is a completely new budding industry. EVs, both on the OEM side, but also in the EV charger deployment sector. CCS, so as you mentioned, biofuels, RNG, and RNG are you know, growing and seeing a lot of interest. And so there's a lot of places to pick from. I think for us, we really gravitate to places where we have prior domain expertise and experience ourselves, where we can be really knowledgeable and supportive of companies. And so we've really narrowed that down into the really in the power generation, EV charging. Think of it as really anything that creates or touches electrons. We think of that as something, you know, easy to understand. It has legacy trends, and again, it's something our team really gets. You know, some other sectors, given that we're not investing in technology risk or, you know, things that might be more venture focused. You know, green hydrogen, not particularly an area where we're, you know, we're observing. I think long term potential opportunity, but not out of the gate looking there. CCS is a unique industry, but still kind of requires some technological sort of, and they're very large projects and continued development there. And biofuel and RNG are areas we have some experience in, but we've predominantly seen just better returns and opportunity in the depth of what's happening and what we call the electrification continuum. It's of the energy transition verticals, it's the one that we think is the deepest and has the most exciting prospects for us to focus on.
So, in your view now, how do you think the IRA has impacted your strategy, your views on the market as it relates to electrification?
Yeah, it's amazing. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Phoenix for the InfoCast Storage Conference. You know, and we're talking a few quarters, you know, but the 9 months after the IRA came to life, and people are still digesting it. It's kind of, you know, it goes without saying how big of a order of magnitude it's going to have on impact across so many different industries, and people are still digesting it. I think for us, how does it impact our strategy? I think it's really interesting how it's creating certainty on tax credit availability. When you think about the solar industries and the solar coaster historically, you know, always had this cliff that is effectively gone. You have onshoring of domestic manufacturing of solar panels and other components and adders to tax credits that materially change the unit economics of a project. I think that's going to create a really robust domestic manufacturing base and competitiveness on panel supply that's only going to help the people that are developing, building, owning, operating assets long term. I think another big aspect is how transferability creates liquidity in the tax equity market. You know, I think the IRA on the other side, you know, we'll always have to have kind of a skeptic view. What does it do that could be negative? It is creating a lot of hype and flow into certain assets that I think we need to be mindful of that might over-incentivize, create too much capacity, and basically create just decreasing unit economic attractiveness of certain parts of the market. So, you know, I think there's a lot of excitement about what it's doing, and those impacts are already being felt. But I think we also need to be mindful of, is the IRA over-incentivizing a bit? Did it overshoot? And I think you could make an argument that it definitely did in certain areas. And we want to make sure we're on the right side of that trade and not, you know, entering into markets where it's going to be a race to the bottom because the incentives create that dynamic.
So, fast forwarding to today, obviously we're in a macro environment, flooded with higher interest rates and inflationary views. And I guess we'll get to the 2024 election a little bit later in the program. But how does today's environment, well, we should start off with what's your view on the environment today? And in terms of its sustainability, which is the wrong word to use here, but you know what I mean. And then also, how does it affect your investment approach?
Yeah, it's Something we think about a lot. And I think we can't get caught prognosticating about where the market's going to go. I think if we knew that, should be investing in different types of securities and other things. I think we just have to create really and invest in defensible businesses that, regardless of macroeconomic environment, are going to be able to sustain through any potential downturn. So I think what's interesting as it pertains specifically to our industry is how does the cost of capital going to be impacted here? I think renewables and real assets and sort of the ESG world have benefited from stickiness of attractive cost of capital. And it seems that is holding. So I would say kind of if you look at spreads to treasuries, spreads have tightened for renewable assets and haven't traded up, basis point for basis point with where interest rates have risen.
That's truly amazing to think about. But that's totally understood given all the interest in the market today.
It is, but that only lasts so long. When a fund manager has an investment grade bond at 8% or a solar project at 8-9% on a levered equity basis, that dynamic only can last so long. What I was fearful of, I'd say 12 to 18 months ago, was if you think about renewable assets as long duration securities in a sense, because these are long lived assets. When you have rates rise and cost of capital rise, that duration length creates pain on pricing of securities. And you could use SVB as an example of seeing that happen at its worst form. But fortunately, you haven't seen like write downs of books or underperformance because of interest rate change, and it's held true. I think what in the development world, if you're thinking about deploying new assets and tapping the capital markets, there's all these levers in assets that you need to think about how do those change in this environment. We've been fortunate that PPA rates have seen increases to compensate for cost of capital rises. Have seen PPAs get renegotiated and recast thanks to these corporates and off-takers who have mandates that need the project. They can't just stick it to the developer and say they're willing to come to the table and renegotiate. So there's dynamics here outside of just interest rates that have to be factored in with the macro environment. Is the ESG sort of mandates from corporates and requirements for decommissioning of coal and legacy fossil fuel assets, is that going to change with the market environment? I think that's I don't think that's likely. And so I think it's the balance of are these macro factors going to change the way the unit economics of a long-term wind solar storage project perform. I think there's other elements that will still make assets and development very attractive. And I could see the industry moving past it, but I think that's with a cautious level of optimism, frankly. There's a lot more that can happen as the next few shoes drop in the banking market. There's a lot of underwater commercial real estate paper sitting on bank balance sheets. It'll be interesting to see how the bank market responds and if the private lending market comes in and fills that gap, particularly in renewables, as there's a lot more assets to get built that require debt and long-term funding in the years to come.
And as we get into some of those emerging technologies, the size of these projects also starts to get bigger and bigger as well. As it's been described already that some projects like some hydrogen complexes that have been talked about and carbon capture will be in line with what LNG projects have cost in the past and will cost today, maybe a little bit less, but still quite expensive, in the billions. So getting to some of these micro issues, interconnection delays, it's obviously been a huge story in the past couple of years, particularly in PJM and MISO, and both RTOs are going through their own reform processes right now to hopefully get rid of the logjam somewhat. But how does this impact you guys from an underwriting perspective when investing in greenfield developers?
Yeah, it's it's definitely an art, not a science, trying to understand how this is all going to play out. It's good that the problem has been identified and that the powers that be are coming up with solutions to fix that logjam, but there's fear, at least for me personally, that once they make that fix, there's going to be new problems that come about, or just another flood of development. So how do you think about that, investing in a space that is having these reforms? I think it comes down to a level of diversification. It comes down to a level of understanding the intricacies of these processes and what can you do to evaluate interconnection cost risk. For the most part, the delays, themselves, you can withstand. When you look at the economics of a solar or wind project development, it really does require just patience and durability of your capital sitting in deposits. The economics are still there from a development fee standpoint relative to cost. I think where the challenge comes in is how do you think about point of interconnection, system upgrade cost? That is a big unknown factor. So I think being really diligent about that and knowing the intricacies of certain markets, but also being diversified enough so that you're not over-concentrated in PJM, over-concentrated in MISO, and you have a strategy that allows you to have different projects and different markets coming on, so that you can, play the long game on some of these markets that are going to require you to be extremely patient.
Thanks for that. Another topic that's come up quite quickly, well, not quickly, it's been known for quite some time now, was that the IRA introduced transferability for tax credits, was looked at as a big moment for the industry in the sense of a real opportunity to expand that market, and at a time when these projects will probably need an expanded tax equity market. Talk to me about transferability and how it's going to affect the project finance market on one level, and also how Ultra looks at its own investments.
Yeah, tax credit transferability has huge ramifications on our business and our portfolio companies. We're in working with our companies right now on transactions that are going to leverage transferability of their tax credits. It's really interesting to see how the market has responded very, very quickly now that the IRS guidance is out, and that there's a level of financial innovation that's happening in a market that really hasn't changed a lot in our view in the past decade or two. So I don't think there's a winner take all aspects to who's going to dominate. I think there's going to be multiple solutions that support this creation of liquidity and transactional ease that is coming relative to what we had in the past. What I will say is that when you look at the IRA and how many other tax credit programs were created, I think transferability is helpful to create liquidity, but there is a lot more work to do to unlock demand for a lot of these tax credits that are coming to market. You have the ITC and PTC, you have storage now, you have 45Q, you have all of the incentives for solar panel manufacturing that are going to be starting to be created, 3, 4 years down the line when all of these domestic manufacturing facilities come online, and a part of their revenue is creating tax credits for every panel they ship. So, I think there's still a lot of work to do. I think in the near term, there's still liquidity. How does that play out with potential changes in the macro environment? If, banks start to underwrite loan books and have a lot of challenges on taxable income and their demand for tax equity, I think you're going to have new places to distribute and place those credits. Transferability is a big part to opening up the investor base. And I think there's really good groups that are out there that have leveraged their networks and other tax credit markets in order to create demand and expand. And I think the legacy, JP Morgan, B of A, all the big tax equity players in the marketplace are going to have a huge role to play in the years to come. So it's for us curating those relationships to benefit our portfolio companies and having our ear to ground about how the market's evolving so that we can be most efficient and also transact quickly and cheaply as we're putting more assets into the ground.
Great. Are there any other markets outside of the U.S. you guys are looking at right now? I did recently do a story involving Canada passing their budget in March, which included some tax credit incentives of their own, which will impact the green hydrogen industry over there, among other things. But just curious if you guys are looking at any other geographies right now and why they might be attractive or not.
Yeah, our part of our investment in On Energy recently was in looking at their business in Latin America. So that was one of the initial investments for us outside of the U.S. Very interesting what's happening in those markets relative to storage and grid security, a whole different type of use case for storage. So that's an interesting place that storage has had a different economic case that we think is really interesting. And in Canada, you know, I think looking at a lot of the fleet electrification and EV charging particularly is an initial space we're looking at there. Not so much on power generation and the utility scale side of the market, but I have to say though, the US market, as deep as it is and as evolving as it is, you know, there is so much change happening right here at home that we don't really have to go look overseas for returns, because I think there's so much change happening. There's so much so many interesting kind of companies building the IPPs of the future that need a capital source like ours, that there's more than enough opportunity here for us. So I would say it's a secondary. We're looking at it, but we're happy to stay right here at home as well, since the market is still fairly attractive.
So let's talk about the opportunity in decarbonization from an industrial point of view. That has come up more often than not, you know, as a almost like a private equity style opportunity, you know, in some cases. In other cases, you have Brookfield coming forward saying we're going to decarbonize our entire office portfolio, which is quite a handful given their portfolio. But I'm just wondering if this is something that you guys are looking at. And it seems like a kind of a very fragmented industry, but one that's growing. And just some of your observations about that particular end of the spectrum.
Yeah, when you look at, you know, what we call the electrification continuum, supply side is changing a lot, how industry procures its power and where it does and the mandates that it has. But on the other side, the demand side for industry is changing drastically as well. You're having mandates to convert fleet to EVs, to, you know, either purchase RECs or have direct PPAs, so kind of limiting scope 2 emissions. But then even when they're within their own operations, you see huge power needs from data centers that need specific reliable power, but also has to be green as well. So it's a unique dynamic happening. And industrial decarbonization is a very broad catch-all terms, but so many things fall within that, including, you know, the demand response, deregulation of energy markets, how industry is creating its heat, is there electrical sources or green hydrogen that can do that. So yes, it is fairly fragmented because there's so many different options. And I think another challenge is that the C&I space generically in solar, you've always seen that has a higher cost of customer acquisition, higher friction and transaction cost generally. So how is that evolving with things like software and technology and identifying opportunity and evaluating usage data? I think that is lowering the barriers and the cost to develop solutions, but it's also still, it's still early days. You still see a lot of buildings, a lot of big players with massive real estate portfolios trying to find their way through the forest. And it's not easy. There's so many different things that they need to consider. And at the end of the day, if you talk to a building manager who's the person that has to keep the lights on at a property, you know, they have 1,000 things on their mind. Decarbonizing their electrons, like, they really just want to make sure they show up and the power stays on. And decarbonizing is sort of something that they're now being forced to from up above to focus on. And so I think there needs to be more education, more clarity, and less noise around what options they have. And so companies that can come in and do, you know, multiple solutions and provide a menu of options, whether that be on procurement or multiple options on, say, EV charger deployment, so that, you know, folks in industry, there's no one size that fits all. I think it's going to continue to be that way. And I think the type of companies that we invest in are ones that can be customer focused, can customize solutions in this segment, because it's very deep, and now you have demand again, coming through mandates, coming from requirement, that it's almost like a compliance obligation versus being a voluntary thing that they do to feel good about it. It's coming from above. It's driving a lot of this change. It's, again, still early days. CNI Solar has been along for a long time. Now you can add storage and EV charging and all these other elements to the CNI space that are exciting. It's still early days, an exciting place for us to be focused on and work with our companies on.
Great. Thanks for that. And to close us out, you wish to speak about investor perspective on policy risk with the 2024 election, which is now getting frighteningly closer as the months gone by. I had to look up what the odds were before we got on air, Mike, and it looks like the top two candidates, to no surprise, are our existing president as well as our previous president, with some other folks behind them. But I'm curious what you're hearing out there and how you're approaching things.
Yeah, I mean, as an investor, we don't make calls. We have to look at a lot of scenarios that are possible. And I think we think all the time about what happens if there's a change in administration in 2024. And I think we need to position our companies that in either of those, if either of those pathways happen, they are prepared and are still have defensible businesses that can achieve their goals. What I think was interesting in the debt ceiling discussion about how, you know, Republicans were going after the aspects of the IRA, it's still not untouchable. Fortunately, you know, we kind of got to think about where the impact of the IRA is being felt or is going to be felt over the next 18 months. Fortunately, there's a lot of development in traditionally red states. Qcells building a huge plant in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. She's even on record saying, "I love Qcells." You know, so I think they took one for the team for the industry, thankfully. But you know, I don't think you can really predict any rational thought or actions coming out of anything out of Washington. And so you do have to kind of say, you know, you do believe that certain things are going to be there in place. I think we've made a fundamental, you know, decision that the solar ITC and the storage ITC are going to be there. They have been there in the past. The things that were there pre-IRA, we think have durability. Do they try to snipe off things, you know, on the fringes or other sectors or industries? Potentially. But at the end of the day, I don't think we can be investing in or don't want to be investing in anything that is 100% driven by IRA. We're really looking for defensible cases for companies that will, you know, thrive and grow regardless of the political climate dynamic. Time will tell. If you have any other additional insights, I think we're listeners on this topic more so than prognosticators, because there's a lot of voices out there that we're trying to understand what could happen if things reverse course and we're looking at a trimmed down IRA post 2024 and what that looks like.
Well, I was about to say, continuing on that thought pattern, the domestic manufacturing incentives, if you think about it, the labor force that's resulting from that in the next couple of years is going to be incrementally a lot bigger than the folks that are developing these projects, in a sense, right? So it's like, from a bipartisan perspective, you'd expect it to be just as much everybody being on the same page and holding hands from that perspective. If that's the case, then if everybody hits their targets, like you say, with Hanwha and all the battery storage guys that are coming here in the next few years and others. So be interesting to watch. Anyway, go ahead.
No, I totally agree with you. I think the, again, rational thinking doesn't always, unfortunately, carry weight. I mean, when Trump came in 2016, when he was asked a question, it was, well, what did Obama do? And he just chose the opposite. No, rational thinking. It just chose the opposite. So, you know, I don't think there's anything that's, you know, not up for debate. The fortunate thing is that where you need legislative change to enact these things is, you know, the Senate has one seat in Pennsylvania that really changed the dynamic of could the Senate flip in 2024 as well, which I think is material. But I think this more investment, and when you look at manufacturing labor statistics and unemployment and things like that, you know, there is a manufacturing renaissance happening in this country. The data shows it. I think you're going to see it presented loud and clear over the next 18 months. We'll see if the country responds to that in a positive way. Either way, we're preparing for either event to happen in our investments and with our companies, because as we know, you never know what's going to happen.
Great. Well, that's about all the time we have, Mike. Thank you again for joining me today. This has been John Burke, Managing Editor of NPM. And thanks again for joining us, Mike. And please tune in next time. Burke out.